7BR Part Heard. Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. This week is an extension of the discussion from our last episode on what a COVID-19 inquiry might look like, as we examine in more detail questions like when will the inquiry begin, what will the terms of reference be, and who will the core participants be. I'm joined once again by Ross Beaton, and also this time by Christina Lyons. Christina is a civil and public law practitioner. She has extensive experience in group litigation and multi-party actions representing the victims of historical sexual and physical abuse, and since 2017 has been instructed as junior counsel by the Commissioner for the Met Police in the undercover policing inquiry. Christina and Ross, thanks for joining me. Over recent weeks, there has been pressure from particular groups, including Brie families, trade unions, and the likes of the British Medical Association, to have an inquiry sooner rather than later. But perhaps you could talk about what are the relative advantages of or disadvantages of having this set up quickly versus waiting perhaps even years.
Well, there's a general rule in inquests that they're supposed to be opened as soon as possible. As soon as it becomes clear that there needs to be an investigation into a death, the coroner basically gets on with it. That's the law. There will be inquests up and down the country into COVID that haven't been opened yet, only because of the backlog in the coroner's court system that's been caused by COVID itself. All of those inquests will have to be opened now, essentially. There's another general rule in the coroner's system that inquests are supposed to be concluded within 12 months of the death. Now, that doesn't always happen, but there's expected to be an explanation as to why it doesn't happen. So I think the same expectations would apply to any COVID inquiry. If it's not going to be prompt, people will ask, why not? Furthermore, as we've seen in recent days with the debate around quarantine in Spain, the concerns around a second wave or further spikes elsewhere in Europe, this is a disease that could well come back quite quickly. And in terms of learning lessons, there might be some lessons that we would want to learn really very quickly indeed. So getting on with getting an inquiry started would seem to be imperative. Of course, there's a big difference between getting it started and getting it finished, but I think there's every reason to want to get on with it.
Perhaps the biggest disadvantage in having a COVID-19 inquiry now or relatively soon is that it will ultimately divert some of the government's focus and resources away from controlling the spread of the virus, lifting the restrictions, reopening the economy, and rolling out the various recovery packages that will be needed. This work, some might argue, should be the government's main priority, as well as Brexit. There is work that is being done by parliamentary committees, scientists, and academics to analyze and evaluate serious problems in the government's response to the pandemic. So it's not that the work hasn't begun, it's that perhaps now is not the time for a full-scale, comprehensive public inquiry. So I think that's one argument in favor of perhaps having this inquiry later, few years down the line. I think also I note what you said about inquests, but most inquiries look back at events that have occurred. So for example, the undercover policing inquiry is looking back at undercover policing from 1968 until 2008. Whereas we're still in the middle of this pandemic, and it's unlikely that this pandemic will disappear anytime soon. And that means the government's handling of the pandemic is ongoing. And some argue that any scrutiny of the government's decisions can't properly be carried out, and the impact of their decisions can't properly be assessed until those decisions and the impacts are clear. So that might be another argument for having it later. Finally, I think we have to also remember that although a public inquiry is meant to be independent of the government still retains quite a lot of control over the process. It's the minister that sets the terms of the inquiry, appoints the chair, and may also prevent certain parts of the inquiry being held in public or preventing disclosure of documents given to the inquiry. This government has been in office came into office shortly before this pandemic began, and still has another 4+ years left. the conclusions and recommendations of an inquiry, if it were to start now or even relatively soon, or may be published before the next election, and the decision makers who may be criticized by the inquiry will probably still be in office. And that means there's a potential for the government to influence the scope of the inquiry by narrowing the terms of reference. And so perhaps a better point would be perhaps when this government is no longer in office.
Well, on that issue of the terms of reference, in our last episode, Ross spoke a bit about how essential it is to get that right and broadly what would need to be included within the terms. But now that we've got a bit more time, perhaps you could both speak about what specific issues you think could be examined within the scope of the inquiry.
Well, you've got the obvious ones, which is the cause of death of large numbers of people. That's the most basic thing which any inquiry which was envisaged to replace the rule of individual inquests would have to look into. So did this person die of COVID? When did they contract the infection? Those sorts of basic details set out across potentially 40, 50, 60,000 people. That in itself is already a very major task. Then you're looking at what was known about this disease. When was it known? The speed of the government's initial response, the availability of protective equipment, the availability of testing. All those sorts of issues, I think, inevitably come within the terms of reference of any inquiry. In fact, they're so closely linked to what the inquiry would have to look at that if they were left outside the terms of reference, there probably would be a European court challenge, or at least a high court challenge under Article 2 to the narrowness of those terms of reference. So those are the most basic things. You've also got the devolved administrations working, or lack of working, as they may say, between central government and devolved administrations and local government. You've got issues which, as I think we touched on a little bit last time, how the disease may affect people who actually haven't died of it, but people who have struggled to access healthcare in a timely fashion because of the precautions that have had to be taken and the steps that were taken to essentially shut down large parts of the healthcare system to people who had other conditions, cancer conditions, for instance. There will be people who contracted COVID and lived. What are the effects on them? What treatments are available, will be available for them? That's probably an issue for the future, but by the time that an inquiry is actually taking place, we probably know a lot more about that than we do at the moment. So that's just a brief sketch. I don't know, Christina, if you have anything that you would add to that.
I think those are all good points. I think at the center of this inquiry would be a scrutiny of the government's decision making and their approach to controlling the infection both before and during the peak and its aftermath. And another issue a chair or panel will need to explore is what scientific advice was given and how was it used by the government. Another issue or matter falling within the scope would be the procurement of goods and services. So that is the outsourcing, the viral testing, the contact tracing, the procurement of ventilators, protective equipment, and the coordination of activities with organizations such as the NHS, laboratories, and public health departments. Ross has touched on this already. It's the sort of coordination of public bodies, you know, the way in which the Department of Health and Social Care coordinates with the NHS, Public Health, Health England, local public health departments. That what this pandemic has shown is that did not go smoothly, that there was a sort of structural disconnect, and that contributed substantially to the spread of the virus. And finally, there's also the disproportionate impact on ethnic minority populations. And obviously, the government commissioned this report from Public Health England, but while setting out the obvious, we haven't actually yet got to grips with why this virus is having a disproportionate impact on AIM communities. And there's obviously the economic impact as well that would need to be considered, and also the sort of data compilation and dissemination of information to public bodies and the public at large. So I think we couldn't come up with an exhaustive list today, but certainly those are some of the issues that would have to be considered by a COVID-19 inquiry.
we couldn't come up with an exhaustive list today, not just because you could sit and write it for days, but because, of course, it's a changing picture. We don't know what's going to happen in the next few months. And one issue which comes to mind is around vaccine development. Vaccine development could be prove to be a crucial issue in fighting this pandemic in years to come. That's an area where we're at a very early stage, but it's not hard to see how vaccine development could be a key issue for a future longer term inquiry. And it could actually be an area where positive lessons are learnt and something which looks like a success story for the UK.
Well, it might not be an exhaustive list, but it's definitely a long one. And another significant consideration is the core participants. And clearly, there are likely to be quite a few parties with a specific interest in the inquiry. So I was wondering who it is that you think will make up the core participants.
Well, I think there are some obvious ones. So the bereaved families are almost certain to be core participants, potentially people who have been bereaved or who have suffered adverse health outcomes as a result of not being able to access healthcare for reasons related to lockdown itself rather than to COVID specifically. You've got people who have contracted COVID at work. For instance, they may be separate from other groups. So there are all sorts of individuals, the sorts of individuals who you would expect to be participants in inquests, who you would expect to be designated as core participants or want to be designated as core participants in a public inquiry, probably in some sort of grouping system. So you're unlikely to have separate legal representation for 40 or 50,000 families, not least because there isn't that number of barristers in the whole country. But you're likely to find that lots of them group together, either of their own motion or because the chair or the panel make rulings that they're to be grouped together. You see that sort of thing in the infected blood inquiry, for instance, which is going on at the moment. That's an inquiry into essentially HIV coming into blood that's given to haemophiliacs, and there'll be various different groups within that inquiry. So, or people who died and people who didn't would form two pretty obvious groups with different interests, and they could all be represented together in their own groups. And then, of course, there'll be state participants. So you would see the government is likely to be represented. The UK government is likely to be a single participant, albeit a very big one. You might see the Secretary of State for Health taking the lead on that, or you might see the Cabinet Office coordinating it. But what you're not likely to see is a lot of different Whitehall departments represented individually. The NHS is an arm's length body. It's got its own structure, its own legal existence separate from the government. So they're likely to have core participant status. Public Health England likely to have core participant status. Some of the companies that were involved in testing likely to have different interests from Public Health England. If tests were being procured and not delivered or whatever the case may be, they're likely to be core participants. Care homes, likely to be potentially in different groups, depending on the type of response that they had to the pandemic. So again, as with the terms of reference, you could sit here easily and come up with a very big list. It's probably not possible to come up with an exhaustive list, and there are probably quite a few that I've left out.
So I think I agree with Ros. There'll be a lot of groupings of people who are affected in similar ways by the pandemic. But in terms of individual core participants, the person I'm thinking of is Neil Ferguson, who was a member of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies and then resigned. He might be a single core participant in this inquiry. I think SAGE itself would be a core participant. I think there will be trade unions applying for core participant status. And I think there'll be a number, Royal College of Nursing, British Medical Association, and I think there'll be a number of civil society organisations as well who'll be wishing to participate in any COVID-19 inquiry.
Ros, there you mentioned that the UK government is likely to be a single core participant, but I wondered what sort of role you see the devolved administrations playing in this inquiry.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because obviously you have different governments, effectively, in different parts of the UK with different and overlapping responsibilities. So it's not just the case that there's an English government in England and a Scottish government in Scotland, and they each govern their own parts of the country. The Scottish government, of course, has a lot of responsibilities in Scotland, a lot of powers in Scotland, but there are also powers that it doesn't have, or at least didn't have at the start of the pandemic. So powers around quarantine, for instance. It's the case now that different parts of the UK have different quarantine rules, or at least can impose different quarantine rules, although they've tried to coordinate them in practice. At the start of the pandemic, I think many people in devolved administrations would have said that refusing access to the UK was something for the Foreign Office to do, and something that the Foreign Office didn't do, from the most infected areas. So there's obvious potential for conflict there between central government and devolved government. There's also potential for conflict between central government and local government. And I think we're seeing that going on at the moment in terms of local lockdowns. One thing we touched on last time was, would there be new legislation or would this inquiry just run under the Inquiries Act 2005? And I thought at the time running under the Inquiries Act 2005 was the most likely way forward. But thinking about it now, I'm not so sure, because if you were to run a UK-wide inquiry, it would be something which hasn't really been done before, covering the responses in the different devolved areas as well as centrally, and all the devolved administrations were core participants. You may need new legislation to say we're going to have the same standards, the same system as the Inquiries Act has, but rolled out across the country, placing local coroner's inquests or fatal accident inquiries, as it would have in Scotland. That sort of legislation would be likely to require the consent of the devolved administrations and would be something that would be negotiated between them and the central government. So COVID-19 has presented unprecedented challenges, and it may lead to unprecedented solutions. And a UK-wide inquiry negotiated between the central and devolved administrations could be one of those unprecedented solutions.
Ross and Christina, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ellie.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. You can find part one of this discussion on the podcast section of our website.